the main ingredient. This is the main ingredient. The main ingredient. This is the main ingredient.
The main ingredient. Hello, what's up, everybody? Welcome to The Main Ingredient with David Nayfeld. Thank you very much for joining us. Today, I feel very blessed because our guest is someone that I have had a lot of intimate time with, someone who I consider a mentor, someone who has really given me a lot of guidance, but most importantly, he's shaped the way I view the relationship between kitchen and dining room. Will Gadara was my employer, was my boss for a long time, but we became friends, you know, for a number of years, and he really was someone that opened my eyes to the importance of having clear, honest, and generous communication between the dining room and the kitchen. So when he and I were together at 11 Madison Park was really, I would say, probably the most exciting time in my entire career. And ultimately, I think it was the most exciting time to be at that restaurant. It went from being a 3-star New York Times brasserie, essentially, to being the most iconic restaurant, probably of its time. It received 3 Michelin stars, 4 stars from the New York Times. We won 6 or 7 James Beard Awards, ultimately became the best restaurant in the world. And a lot of that was because of Will's contribution in the dining room and how he ultimately created this, I would say, this pathway for people in the dining room to participate in more than just your standard service experience. So without kind of further ado, you know, I really want to get into what is going to be next on the kind of Will Gadara train, because ultimately I'm excited as a fan, but also as a friend.
Dude, well, it's nice to see you, man. And thanks for the invitation to be on this and the trip down memory lane. For the listeners, David and I became close because for a while you were the AM sous in charge of purchasing, running lunch, and I was in there every day at 9 a.m. And that means in a restaurant like 11 Madison Park, there's not that many people there at 9 a.m. And so when you and I were together every morning at that restaurant, those are some really good memories, not to mention some of the parties we had and the roles that we played. So
the parties were the best. I do want to kind of co-sign something that we threw the best parties in the entire industry. They really straddled this line of almost always crossing the line, but never crossing the line that far. Like, it was always good-hearted fun, I think. Like, you know, it was always, like, this positive experience for everyone there. But it was, like, at the end of it, you'd look at the dining room like, oh, my God, how do we get open for service? There's, like...
No, but, and to be clear, I think sometimes when you cross the line just a little bit, it's fine so long as it's done with intention. One of the things that was super, super important to me, especially during kind of that rise to the top, whether it was getting the 4th star from the New York Times or the 3rd star from Michelin or like rising up the ranks in the world's 50 best, was to, well, internally through conversations with the team, make sure that while we were taking what we were doing really seriously, we didn't start taking ourselves too seriously. And then externally doing things to make sure that the world knew that too. And so whether that was like putting the hot dog on the PDT menu or the big parties we threw or the Kentucky Derby or the Big Apple Barbecue Block Party or just all those things, I think it's one of the things, like, plenty of, you know, it's easy to say publicly, hey, we want to be a new kind of fine dining restaurant. We want to have all of the excellence, but none of the starch, like all of the, you know, the elements of fine dining that people would grow to expect, but not at the expense of like warmth and human connection. It's easy to say that, but until you actually put systems in place and put a ton of intention into doing things that, well, hold yourself accountable to the goal you're trying to realize and kind of scream from the mountaintop to the world that you refuse to, I think it's impossible to kind of stay true to to what you're trying to be.
Right. And, but you know, one thing I wanted to kind of ask you about, and I think this is apropos of later in our conversation, which we'll kind of see, is, you know, that stuff comes at a expense, right? And I mean an actual expense of dollars, right? It takes an investment to do things like, hey, we want to throw this party. We're not going to police everyone who's going nuts, putting like high heel holes in our banquettes. We're not going to like worry about that in this moment. You know, we're going to have these, we're going to shut the restaurant for a number of days so we can sit there and strategize together. Right. And lose that revenue plus pay everyone to be there. I mean, there, when you talk about intention, there was a real intention at that restaurant about how to create, you know, a vibe, right? How to create this kind of like aura of who we were. And a lot of that was around how we party. A lot of it was around how we gather together, how we plan, how we strategize, how we attack things. How did you, first of all, how did you know that those investments were worthwhile? And then also ultimately for a long time, right? Like, how did you get Danny Meyer to sign on to those things and say, hey dude, I'm going to spend your money? Before it was Will's money, it was Danny's money, right? And how did you get someone like Danny to be like, okay, Will, I get it. This isn't just a party just to, you know, just for a party's sake. No, this is about culture. I swear, Danny, this is really important.
Well, and by the way, I promise to answer the question that you asked at the top soon, but I think this is a really important conversation because it touches on something that is like a foundational element of how I believe every business should be run. I actually wrote an article about this for Fast Company. I call it the 95-5 doctrine. You know, Live Madison Park, we ran a good, solid business. You were in the tent long enough to know that, you know, we made money out of Live Madison Park. It wasn't one of those three Michelin star restaurants that never made money, but the 95-5 thing, what that means is you manage your money like a maniac 95% of the time, such that 5% of the time you can spend foolishly. And I put foolishly in quotes because it's not foolish. It's actually very, very intentional. It's just about spending in ways that don't have a clearly defined ROI, that don't have a clearly defined return on investment. That, honestly, that's the role of a leader, is to understand just like to have confidence in your conviction that certain things will yield a good result, even if it's hard to see it on paper right away. And so, yeah, how do you justify the investment of a party to the public? Well, Danny, we'll talk about, I'll answer that part of it. You know, one of the key tenets in how I've always run anything that I've run is creating a culture of collaboration and ownership where you invite people to have a seat at the table and you treat them like owners. And I got that from Danny. Danny always treated me like an owner, from when, honestly, I was a manager at Tabla to running the cafes at MoMA to ultimately running Live Madison Park. He led with trust, right? He never like led the bowling analogy where you put up the bumpers. Like, he'd let me roll a gutter ball and then course correct, but he wasn't always there to tell me not to do something. He gave me permission and autonomy to do things, and well, ultimately they succeeded, so it paid off. But I think when you look at a party or when you look at strategic planning, so long as you're being intentional with how much you're spending and you're balancing that by being very conservative in how you spend the other 95% of the time, if you see a tangible, or even not tangible, if you see a result, if you see an impact, you need to believe in it. You need to go with it. And so those parties, I mean, 11 Madison Park, New York is a tricky place. Like, the more you succeed, the more people want to see you fail.
Do you think we gained staff from people who went to those parties or heard of those parties?
I don't know that we gained staff, but we gained supporters. Maybe we did. I can't say that with confidence, but what I can say with absolute confidence is there was a huge part of the restaurant community that otherwise would have thought we were the annoying, stuffy, fine dining restaurant that they had no desire to see succeed, would go to those parties, and then they'd be on our side. Like, the way to succeed is to have as many people as humanly possible feeling a sense of ownership in your success and willing to scream from the mountaintops that you deserve to succeed. And things like those parties showed people that, well, yeah, we didn't take ourselves too seriously, and we were always willing to lead with generosity.
Right.
And that goes a long way.
So, and as you kind of said, I do want to get to the question that I asked you at the top, but I think the best way to do that is to start with this, which is, you know, when you took the position at 11 Madison Park, you were what, 25?
26,
yeah. 26. So I just want to frame this for everyone. What are most of you doing when you're 26? Right? Like, Will was charged with entirely running, you know, from the dining room perspective and in a lot of ways, the operational perspective, one of the most expensive restaurants in New York, and tasked with turning it into a 4-star, you know, basically shrine to kind of this style of cooking, which, and I don't think anyone knew exactly what 11 Madison Park was going to become, but what it was tasked with initially is the fact that everybody knew they wanted to try and achieve 4 stars, right? Like that was Daniel Hume's goal, that was Danny Meyer's goal, and Will was tasked with coming in there and being able to, you know, at first it was just be able to like keep it together, right? Like I don't think anyone knew that Will was going to come in there and become his own shining star in his own right and creating this new language to service, right? Do you think that 26 was too young for you to have all of that responsibility and ultimately, you know, because it's very hard to say, right? Like you achieved the world, right? And then kind of, you know, but then you went through struggles and you went through your own challenges to kind of get yourself to this point. Do you wish you had that opportunity later in life? Or are you happy for when it happened?
No, I mean, well, there are two questions there. Is 26 too young? No, the answer is definitively no. I don't think there's any age that's too young to do anything. You know, like one of the things is, I think people are always like struggling to find people to put in certain roles because they can't find the people with the right experience. We'll talk about fatherhood later, I'm sure, but no one's ever ready to do anything until they're doing it. That's like one thing that I feel very, very strongly about. And age is relevant only to a certain point. I mean, listen, I had in my dad a mentor and a teacher who groomed me to be a restaurateur from the time I was 12 years old. It's literally the only thing I've ever done. And so at 26, I probably had more experience doing that stuff than most people would years later. But more than that, you know, I'd worked for Danny long enough that he knew me, he could trust me, he understood my character, and he understood that I was in a phase of my life where I was going to work my ass off, right? Like that's one of the things that's amazing about being young in our industry is that when there's nothing else important in your life, you can give everything to your job. And I don't think that's an unhealthy thing. I think that, you know, I was listening to Steve Nash's Hall of Fame acceptance speech the other day, and you should Google it. Go to the last 2 minutes of that speech. It's pretty extraordinary. And he talks about how people are always talking about balance, and balance is very important long-term in your life. But if you haven't spent some season in your life, like maniacally focused on one thing, you're missing out on something, because there is something so enriching and illuminating about just pouring yourself fully into a single pursuit. And I mean, listen, I was at 11 Madison Park for 11 years, and what we accomplished there was extraordinary, and it wouldn't have come without having been in a position to pour myself fully into it. Now is not a time that I would be in a position to do that anymore.
Well, and so I'm glad you said that, because ultimately that brings us to today's world, right? We're talking about, you know, Will just had a birthday. Happy belated birthday.
Thank you very much.
And you're 42 now. And, you know,
wait, is your birthday close to mine? Don't we have very,
mine's October 17th. Yours is November 25th.
Fifth. Good memory.
And so, you're 42, you and your wife now have a nearly 1-year-old daughter.
Yep.
You have a dog, which is To me, you know, if anybody asked when I really became a parent, it was because when I adopted my dog. That's when everything really changed. When I started bringing my dog to investor meetings, and my partner would look at me like, "Really, you're bringing your dog here?" I'm like, "Look, they got to know what my priorities are.
If they're investing in me, they're investing in me and my dog. That's just what it is."
Exactly. And so you're at a very different season in your life. And when you talk about the ability to pour yourself into any one thing, I would say your priorities have shifted as to what that one thing would be. But I think for myself, like I said early on, as a fan, the world wants to know when they will get to experience, or what they will get to experience next, of kind of the, you know, I would say this new style of brand that Will Goddard brought into our lives, of this like fun, thoughtful, experiential way of dining that's more than just about the, you know, utilitarian need to consume food.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll go back a little bit. So, obviously I sold my half of the company end of 2019, beginning of 2020. And then, you know, because I think a lot of this, when you do what we do at a high enough level, it very much becomes a part of your identity. And so just innately, the moment I started selling the company, I was like, all right, I got to start a new one. And so when COVID started, I was a week away from signing 4 leases in New York City. I was about to start a New York City based restaurant group, and I had a bunch of different chef partners lined up and my whole team ready to go. And then COVID started. I obviously didn't sign those leases. Moved up to our house in the country, spent the first month or so trying to keep the leases alive. That's when the whole IRC thing started. Ultimately started devoting most of my attention to the IRC and decided to let those leases go. But was continuing to take meetings about restaurants in New York City. There's plenty of those opportunities. And then about 3 or 4 months into COVID, I just decided to take a moment and stop. I think when what you do is such a big part of how you define who you are, we have a tendency to run back to something. And I think there's the way I articulated that is important. Running back to something is very different than running forward towards something. And so 3 months into COVID, I said, okay, let me just stop. And just give myself the space and the grace to dream about what life could look like if it were going to be different. And by the way, that could also mean that I decide again to do what I was doing before. Do you understand the distinction?
Yeah, of course. You're making a decision with intent versus doing something because of habit.
Yeah, rather than just reverting to the thing you've always done, deciding to do it again. And so basically I decided that, listen, okay, we work together. So you've heard me talk a lot about superpowers, right? Like, I believe we all have superpowers. And if you don't have, bizarrely, a combination of confidence and humility that allows you to name your superpower, you have an inability to leverage it. And if you can't say it out loud to the people you work with, they have an inability to leverage it. I have certain superpowers, right? And one of them is in hospitality, right? Like, I think that I've always been in the hospitality business, not the restaurant business. And the thing that I've been serving happens to be food. My entire approach has been to be as unreasonable in my creative pursuit of how we serve the food as people are in the food itself. And so I know that my next chapter will be in hospitality. I just want it to be a little bit different from the one that I've done before. So I started trying to figure out, what do I not want? When I sold the company, we had about 1,500 employees spread between New York and LA and Aspen and Vegas and London. I know I don't want that many employees again. And I'm intentionally using the word employees, because when we worked together, I never would have called you an employee. You would have been a part of my team. But the moment you grow to a point where you don't know the names of everyone that works with you, it's no longer a team as much as it is a bunch of employees. And I didn't like that relationship. I also decided that I don't want to be in a scenario where I'm on planes half the time. For pretty much the same reason, it's hard. I think we did an extraordinary job of building a really, really powerful culture that went beyond state lines and existed in its own way within the various restaurants. But I want to look back on the culture that I built at 11 Madison Park, or a lot of the things we did at 11 Madison Park, and look at that as a stepping stone to something even greater. And for that to be possible, I need to get back to a place of focus. And so I'll tell you what I do know is I'm only going to do stuff here in New York. And I'd like my professional life to mimic my personal life, which is time spent between the Hudson Valley and New York City. Now, what form that takes remains to be seen. I spent the last 20 years of my life kind of always in a rush to the next thing. And I'm trying to slow down such that I'm not so focused on achieving something new that I can't be patient enough that the thing I achieve is exactly what I want it to be. Yeah. Not sure if any of that makes sense.
No, it all makes sense. And I honestly, it's something that resonates with me on a number of ways. And there's a few things that I wanted to pull away from that. But, you know, personally, as a restaurateur that is constantly thinking about how to grow, right? You know, I've said this before that, you know, during the pandemic, my business partner and I have thought so many different ways around how do we grow, right? Doing business here in San Francisco is very expensive. Doing business in California and the Bay Area is very expensive. And you start to think like, well, maybe we'll do better in a place like Texas. Maybe we'll do better in another state, right? Like we'll get a better bottom line. You know, kind of deal structures changed during COVID, and things became much more opportunistic to continue to do business here for a number of reasons. And I've also become much more involved in our local kind of politics. And I believe that now the course is to change how we do business here in the Bay Area and in California and in the nation, to be honest, more so than doing business everywhere. I still have these fantasies of opening restaurants in places like New York and London and LA and all these things. And who knows if maybe we might go down that path. But what I hear you talking about here is how kind of, and we've already talked about your, you know, stratospheric successes, right? Like those things will never kind of be taken away. But what I hear you talking about is learning from your failure and the idea of, you had something that was so great, and then you were like, oh, there's more, there's more, there's more. I like that. There's more, there's more. It's just like, I can just go out and do more and more and more. And at some point, some of those things failed, right? What do you think, if you had to pinpoint the most important thing you've learned from any failure, what would it be?
I'm going to answer that in a circuitous way. I think one thing about a restaurant, did you hear there was like a stat that like so many people adopted dogs during COVID?
Yeah.
And then this past May, like tons of dogs were being returned.
Yeah. Which is terrible, by the way. I think when people do that, it's complete shit, but yes, I did hear the stat.
So I think like, there's failure and then there's almost regret. And I think there's two different, in some cases they're the same, in some cases they're different. There's been plenty of moments in the last year where someone has called me with this crazy opportunity to do something amazing in New York, no money in. It would be so fun for me. My team would love it. We'd get to go in and do something super creative. Every time I've stopped short of that thing, because a restaurant, it's not like you get to run a restaurant for a while and have fun with it. And then you're like, okay, I'm moving on to the next thing. Like that's your restaurant now for 20 years, right? It's a very, very significant commitment. And to the point of being 26 when I started 11 Madison Park and work is your only focus. as long as work was my only focus, growing, it was awesome and it was fun. But then suddenly you look around and I was getting married and I wanted to start building a family, but I had an entire company that I was responsible for leading. And it's not within my character to just change my mind and to let partners down and to decide that I don't want to do something anymore. Right. And so then you're in a position where you're honestly, your plate is so full that you have an inability to be your best self for any one of the things on it. And so one thing I learned is just because something is, let's even call it objectively awesome, from a conceptual perspective, financial perspective, it gives you the opportunity to grow. It gives people on your team an opportunity to grow, all of those things. Make sure that you're thinking not 1 or 2 or 3 years down the line when you decide to commit to something, but that you're thinking 5, 10, 15 years down the line. Because the decisions we make as operators when we open a restaurant, they're not short-term decisions, they're long-term decisions. and so from my failures, I think more I learned things about myself. I like working with my teams on a daily basis. I don't like being super disconnected from my teams. There are some people that are not only really good at that, but that's what makes them happy, right? They like leading thousands of people and setting up cultures that impact thousands of lives, even lives of people that they'll never know or meet. That's just not who I am. And so that's one thing I learned about myself, which is why I'm trying to take a much more focused approach. But to my first point, that's what has instilled in me this sense of patience. Like, hospitality is this world. I believe every business in America can choose to be a hospitality business. I think that there's opportunities for hospitality, business opportunities, more than I perhaps fully even comprehend. So rather than making like instinctive, gut-driven decisions, I'm trying to just take as much time to learn about everything that's out in the world so I like can fully see the field before getting on it and starting to play again.
Right. Well, and I think what you're speaking to is, you know, someone that I think we're probably both fans of is like the Yvon Chouinard kind of tactic of running a business, right? Like, and anybody who hasn't read the book, Let My People Go Surfing, it's a really important book on how to lead in a unique way, right? And it wouldn't work for everybody and for every company. But what I do think ultimately it does is it brings hospitality into your company, as you were kind of articulating, Will, is that, you know, the idea of thinking about things in a more esoteric way rather than just, you know, top line, bottom line, go through the dailies. Does this make sense from a business standpoint? Does it allow my people to grow? It's like there's so much more texture behind how that gets done and the lives that are involved and the, you know, ultimately the sustainability. I want to go back to something you said and a word that it just, when you said it, it made the hair on the back of my neck stand up. I think it's one of the most important words that when I talk about things that I learned from you, this word maybe represents what I learned from you more than any other word, and it's unreasonable. And the idea of being unreasonable when you are trying to attack a goal, and ultimately, I mean, you know, and I'm not trying to blow smoke up your ass here, Will. I think the fact that I learned how to be unreasonable from you is the reason why I spent 4 years opening KFICO when so many people told me that it was going to be a lost cause. Like, hey, man, this isn't happening for you. You're not going to get the investors you need. Hey, man, you're not going to be able to turn this auto body garage into a restaurant. Hey, man, like, let's do something easier or whatever. And look, to the great credit of my business partner, Matt Brewer, you know, he stuck it out, right? He stuck it out for us to open this restaurant. But really, I think that kind of like unwillingness to believe anyone's good advice that this was not going to happen for me. And I mean, I even remember like 2 years into the process, I sent you an email like, hey, like, do you have this or do you know this thing? And you're like, you know what, man? I'm just impressed that you're still doing this. Like, I'm proud of you for still even doing it. And it wasn't this thing of like, you know, I hadn't even achieved anything at that point. But the fact that I still had the stick-to-itiveness, you even applauded that. And I hadn't even done anything. Talk to me about being unreasonable, when it's right and when it's wrong.
Well, it's such a funny word. And I've gotten into arguments with people even recently about it, because people say it implicitly brings with it a negative connotation. But I couldn't disagree more. I just think it's about what you're being unreasonable in pursuit of. First of all, like to your story, listen, nothing great ever happens with a reasonable approach, right? It's not like Michael Phelps like woke up every once in a day and said, you know, I'm going to do a reasonable amount of swimming today, right? Like that's not how the world works.
Yeah, Steph Curry doesn't shoot a reasonable amount of shots from the perimeter, yeah. Right?
Yeah, and anyone, by the way, like anyone that like looks at people and says they're natural talents and da-da-da-da-da-da, like you haven't actually learned their story, because no one has succeeded or achieved anything at any level of greatness without like being unreasonable in their pursuit of it. But like one of the things I talk about all the time is unreasonable hospitality. And like for me, like you can't have a more positive connotation to the word unreasonable than when you put it before hospitality, right? Like I think it has to do with hospitality and the way you treat the people you're serving and also the people that you're working with. Like if you are unreasonable in your pursuit of giving people a sense of belonging, if you're unreasonable in making people feel seen, if you're unreasonable in encouraging people and pushing them to succeed, if you're unreasonable in wanting people to feel that the night they had in your restaurant like will ultimately become like an exclamation point in the autobiography of their lives, like that's beautiful stuff, right? And it's only when you give yourself permission to be unreasonable and celebrate it as a superpower, I think, that you have the capacity to really like make some of your biggest dreams come true.
So we talked earlier about the fact that you had been groomed for this industry, right? Your father is an iconic restaurateur, someone who's been in this industry a very long time, and it's been well documented, his background. So I won't get into it further. But you know, we are in a kind of industry today, which, you know, especially in this country, and I'd say a lot of other countries are headed down this hole, which we've made it nearly impossible to apprentice, right? And why is that? So I'll get into this, right? The labor laws as they're set up in this country make it very hard for anyone to go and learn on the job, right? And there are still these ways that people can go to culinary school and spend a tremendous amount of money. And then there is a loophole in which they are allowed to go learn for a lesser amount or for free, doing something that's known as a externship. The rest of the world knows it as an internship. And, you know, I think, and I've said this a number of times, it would be so great if we could figure out how to give high school students the opportunity without having to shell out a ton of money to go to culinary school or to college or anything else, to go work at restaurants, or not even just restaurants, right? Like being a painter, being an electrician, being a mechanic, anything that the world continues to need, you know, and have the government support that in a way that allows people to get into these industries and get experience and allows these small businesses oftentimes, right? Like, look, McDonald's doesn't need the help. But like an independent restaurant taking on someone from high school comes as at a great expense, right? You know, the training for doing that job, the mistakes that are made, you know, it's not like you let them be alone and they fly and you're like, hey, like I'll course correct you once in a while. Oftentimes you're still having to have someone else who you're paying also to do the work, shadow them step by step, making sure that all of these things are done right, at least at quality restaurants that you and I are used to working in. Talk a little bit about the idea of apprenticeship, and do you have any creative ideas in which we can still promote this, you know, and whether that takes legislative change or whether that's something as an industry that we can continue to promote from a business model standpoint.
Hmm. You know, it's interesting the way you articulated it just a moment ago. It's the first time I've ever made the connection that the only way you're allowed to work for free in a restaurant is if you pay someone a bunch of money so that you're allowed to work for free in a restaurant.
Exactly right. Which has a bigotry of its own.
Yeah. I mean, listen, here's the deal. Like, I understand why there's so much legislation around apprenticeships now, because like anything, you know, you can only judge a program by the most like insidious person that abuses it. Right. And there's so many people out there that I'm sure have abused those programs. And we both know a handful of the same people that likely have. But I mean, you are right in the sense that like, how many people do we hire over the years from the Culinary Institute or from, you know, the French Culinary Institute or all these different places who spent a ton of money, came to work in the kitchen, and it was their first time really, really working in the kitchen, or they came to work in the dining room, it was their first time really working in the dining room. And then after 6 months of experiencing it, they realized that's not actually what they wanted to do for a living, and then ultimately had all this debt from culinary school that had they had some amount of experience just to get their feet wet, they perhaps could have learned.
I'd say the majority, right? The majority of people that went to culinary school.
A lot of people. I mean, do I have any creative ideas? It's not something I've spent a ton of time thinking about. I will say one thing I've been thinking about. Listen, the staffing shortage in our industry, there's like a lot of issues, and I always try to think about how you can create a win-win-win. Like, what are the best levers, right? Like, that's how I always think about how to improve a culture, how to change a business model, is like, what is one thing that you can do that takes the least amount of energy and has the greatest impact? And start with that, and then move on to the next thing. What I saw over the course of COVID was so many people were displaced from their jobs in restaurants and out of necessity got other jobs, right? And I've seen so many restaurant people that are now working in customer service at places like Amazon or all these places. They're working better hours. They're getting paid more money. And now we're having a hard time recruiting people back into the restaurant business for two reasons. One, a lot of the people that used to work in restaurants have moved on, and that next generation of people that will go on to replace them, it's just going to take time for them to either come of age or kind of be developed into that career. But then also save the people that are good enough to really excel and rise up the ladder. It's not the best job, right? Like, you can make more money doing other things and working less, right? We, in our places, have always thrived because we've created a culture of hospitality and excellence. And anyone that really wants to pursue a career in this, that's the place to go, because you're learning from the best and you can go on and make it your own. But I do believe that that's not the case with a great majority of our industry. And the thing that we need more than anything else is like to be more professionalized, for people to see a real career path.
Is that all about income?
I think a lot of it is about income. I think as much as I've never made decisions based on income, it's always been based on passion. I've been lucky in that the income has come, but I also know that for a lot of people, you need to make decisions on income. I do believe, though, that there's something in the fact that all of these big tech companies filled their customer service jobs with people who used to work in restaurants. Like, restaurants can be a career, they can be like a training ground for other industries as well. Like, the skills that we teach people in restaurants, they're not getting taught anywhere else. They're certainly not getting taught them at college or business school or even culinary school. They're certainly not getting taught them in banks or tech companies. These soft skills, these interpersonal skills, like learning the nobility of service, learning how good it feels to make someone else happy, like understanding the stress that comes from like putting up a four top and doing it perfectly where every dish is hot. Like, the skills that come from learning, from working in restaurants, I think are very, very unique and universally applicable. And when I think about apprenticing in restaurants, I also think about how to create like more awareness that if you go to work in restaurants, you're going to learn skills that can help you find success in other industries as well. And I think if that is something that we can accomplish, it will professionalize our industry and make some of the jobs that people don't necessarily want to take a more clearly defined stepping stone to the things that they do want to do. And the moment you can see the value of every day that you spend doing something, I think it becomes inherently more enjoyable and more meaningful. I don't know. Is this all too meta? Are you saying?
No. I don't think it's too meta at all. I do think that I want to kind of, you know, get you to say something here that, you know, or disagree with this, but how much of this is about the way we price things in restaurants? You know, because at the end of the day, if for example, San Francisco, right? The average office worker, right? Like white collar office worker. I'm not talking about high power attorneys. I'm not talking about executives. I'm talking about the average office worker here makes $177,000 a year. The average retail worker makes $42,000 a year. At some point, we're going to have to bridge that divide, or we are not going to be able to get anyone to work in our industry that is not doing it for a very particular reason, that they want to be a chef and open a restaurant, or they want to be, you know, a master sommelier or something like that, right? Which is not the majority of the people are in our industry. I've looked at our business model 1,000 ways from Sunday. I've seen a lot of other people's business models. And at the end of the day, I think there's only so much massaging you can do to the point where you're at 0% bottom line, to where even people like us aren't going to do it anymore because you can't do these things at a loss. How much of this is incumbent upon our guests to recognize that they are shareholders here, they are our partners here, and if they want to continue to enjoy great independent restaurants at every level, that they need to be more willing to pay for the experience. And the experience now is less around just paying for the ingredient of food, but it's around paying for human capital.
Okay, yeah, price is definitely an issue. I look at it as, I'm gonna get there in just a sec. The business model, like we're dealing with two different things, right? COVID showed the people that were most vulnerable, like the human beings, right? Like if you had an underlying condition, you were most susceptible to COVID. It also showed the industries that were most vulnerable, and we were one of the first on the chopping block, right? In addition to the fact that we were public gathering places, our margins were also so thin that no restaurant had like millions of dollars in the bank, right? To like, you know, weather any long storm. And now we're facing the staffing crisis, which very reasonably people want a better balance of life and they want to make more. But those two things aren't friends, right? Like we're already in a place where we're struggling to get by, where the margins aren't big enough. And then we're also really, I think most of us were in the hospitality business. We want to make people happy. We'd all love to be able to pay more and do all of that stuff, but you need the money in your bank account in order to pay more. And so, yeah, one of those things is prices need to go up, right? Because the business model just doesn't work. There's not enough dollars and cents to make everyone happy. And by the way, a lot of the people out there that are the first to scream and shout about the fact that restaurants aren't paying their teams well enough are going to be the first people to scream and shout the moment you raise your prices.
Of course.
I think it's an interesting, like, it's a challenge. I mean, there's other things as well, though, right? Like payroll taxes. There's a lot there. The government can actually do a lot there. Like the amount of people that are employed in a 3,000 square foot restaurant versus the number of people that are employed in a 3,000 square foot Chase Bank. I mean, it's like 10 to 1.
Right.
Right. There should be incentive to hire more people and employ more people, not a lack thereof, especially with increased automation. I mean, that's the other thing. Like more and more restaurants are going to figure out ways to automate stuff so that they can pay less people and ideally pay the people that are left more. But there should be incentive and encouragement to continue employing as many people as possible.
Right. And to train them to do something well, right? You know, and that kind of goes back to the apprenticeship thing, right? Like we're not trying to train people to scoop things onto trays. You want to train people to know how to break down a fish, break down a side of beef, treat vegetables well, serve them in a very, very thoughtful way that's good to the environment, right? Like you want to teach people more than just how to assemble.
Yes. I mean, listen, I think the solution is threefold. And by the way, I'm a Democrat, but living in San Francisco, I mean, the politics must drive you crazy, right? Because the same people that believe in workers' rights are not actually doing the things they need to do to support the owners such that they have the ability to invest in people right. being paid a living wage.
I talk about it all the time, right? The same people who are voting for, you know, higher, you know, rates of labor, like the higher minimum wage. That's me. I want to pay people enough money. My partner and I, we pay an exorbitant amount of money to people such that they can live here. They can afford to exist on one job. But those same people, it's the same demographic, come in and then they're like, wait, I don't understand. Why are you charging us 10% to dine inside of your restaurant? Well, we're charging that such that even a host makes a very minimum of $55,000 a year, or a porter makes a very minimum of $55,000 a year, even at the most introductory level of the job, right? And that our line cooks are making upwards of $68,000 a year to work 5 days, right? Like, that's a tremendous amount of money comparative to what you and I saw even 10 years ago in terms of sous chefs at the best restaurants in the world were making $45,000 a year. That's just something that has to change. And when we are talking about democratically ran cities, right? And I don't want to bully them because obviously I live in one, I vote that way. But we need to be more aligned with our own values here, that when we see the pricing in a restaurant, when we see the pricing in a business, when we see the upcharge that a delivery app should be charging you as the consumer to get something delivered to you on your couch while you're wearing your pajamas, is something that's worth investing in, right?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I believe that restaurants need to start charging more. And it's a very tricky conversation because how do you get everyone to start doing it such that the first movers don't get dinged, and you can't get everyone to do it without engaging yourself in an antitrust lawsuit, right? There's all sorts of stuff there. But restaurants do need to charge more. I believe automation is going to be a part of it, right? Like, I'd rather figure out a way, and there are things, you and I, if we like really sat down for a couple hours and we had whatever fucking Elon Musk sitting next to us with his robotics division behind him, we could automate a certain number of positions in our restaurant and it would still deliver the kind of quality we're accustomed to, sure, such that we're able to pay the people that remain more. And I think there's legislative stuff that can be done. And my hope is, once the IRC gets through replenishing the restaurant relief fund, that we can move on to other things that, I mean, listen, like, that's one of the best things to come out of COVID is the IRC, right? And the fact that we finally have the sense of community and through our collective strength, the ability to make change. We've been fighting so hard to stay alive that we haven't necessarily had the bandwidth or the wherewithal to start fighting for the things that will make it a better life. And my hope is that in that next stage, real significant work can be done such that we're all able to thrive, not just the owners, but the guests, the people that work there, and everyone in between.
Right. So let's talk about a better life. You know, over the past, you know, within the past year, you've become a father. And anyone who's heard me talk about my experience with fatherhood, I use the same kind of, you know, analogy or saying every time, whereas before, if my restaurant was on fire, I would have been inside the restaurant with the fire hose trying to put it out just so I could make it in time for service, right? Whereas now the restaurant could be on fire, and if my daughter needed a diaper change, that would take precedence over me whatsoever focusing on my restaurant. And that has completely changed my perspective. It's completely changed how I view my goals. Now, I still have the same goals, but it changes my pursuit of them and how I view how I'm going to attack those things. And I know there's a lot of people listening right now that says, man, that sounds awful, right? Like, you had this freedom to pursue your goals in any way you saw fit, and now you have this thing in your life that stops you from that or alters that or makes you consider it, right? And I would say that the parents who are listening to this will understand that all of a sudden when your child comes into the world and looks at you and holds your finger with that little hand And like the moment they learn how to grip your finger, the moment you can smell their skin, all of a sudden everything in the world seems so small and that seems so big. How has life changed for you in the way you view your goals? And I know that you've touched a lot on this and staying like within the circumference of New York and staying within, you know, places that you, you know, kind of that are parallel to your social life. Can you talk a little bit more about how it's changed maybe your approach to moving forward in all aspects of this industry?
So, yes. Having a daughter has not made me any less ambitious. I think that's one thing that's important to articulate. But I think you said the same thing in different words. It's not made you less ambitious. Here's the thing. I think having a daughter, one, has made me a better leader, right?
Oh,
because
for sure.
I think one of the things you need to be good at to be a great leader is, well, you need to be consistent and you need to be patient. You can't make it through a month as a new dad without being consistent and patient. But I think the moment you have another very, very significant priority, and in this case, something that actually sits above the others on the list of priorities, the better you're going to be at dealing with the others. When I'm in a meeting right now, brainstorming something or dealing with an issue that I'm facing and something that I'm trying to get done, I'm just as intense as I ever was when we worked together and over the past 20 years. The thing that's different, and I haven't been asked this question before, and so I'm trying to find the words to articulate exactly what's in my head right now. I care just as deeply about getting something right as I ever did, but not getting it right is not the end of the world anymore. And I believe that's making me better, because when you're faced with a decision, and if you get it wrong, it's the end of the world. It's never actually been the end of the world, right? That's just the framework and the mental state of mind I've been in my entire life, because
sense of urgency.
I've been so like maniacally focused on whatever goal that I'm trying to achieve. When you're faced with a decision and getting it wrong feels like the end of the world, I believe it clouds your judgment to some extent. And when you suddenly have this other, different, objectively bigger priority in your life that makes the other one, it just kind of resizes it a little bit and honestly puts it into focus, it unclouds your judgment. And when you suddenly look at the decision based on what's the good decision versus the bad decision, as opposed to what's the right decision and what is like the one that will destroy my world if I don't get it right, I'm finding it easier to find clarity. I see my business world more clearly now than I did before, because I'm more capable of taking a step back from whatever issues in front of me and seeing the forest through the trees. Suddenly, in spite of the fact that I'm just as close to it, I don't feel as close to it. And I want to celebrate that, and I want to make sure I hold on to that.
So your relationship with your father, like I said, is well documented, and how, you know, the situation at your home played a major role in how often you had to be with your father, right? And ultimately, you had to be at work with him a lot of times, or you had to kind of be at his hip. Talk to me a little bit about, you know, and obviously you guys have the closest relationship ever. Talk to me a little bit about what of that you want to try and reenact with your daughter. And what of that maybe you feel like maybe took a little bit of your childhood away and you maybe you're not going to reenact.
I mean, and I'm not, I really mean this. There's nothing that falls into the second category. Like if someone walked up to me today and gave me a check for $1 billion and said I never needed to work again, I will still open another restaurant or something like a restaurant just so that she has to work at it growing up, because I don't want her to get older without having like bust other people's dirty plates or changed their sheets or whatever it is. I actually believe that growing up in restaurants has made me who I am and is responsible for the best parts of who I am.
Yeah, it makes you a better person. I agree.
I also just think, like, I mean, listen, my dad, we lived in Westchester. He worked in the city. When I go to work with him, we drive together. That was a 45-minute drive each way. He never, when he put me to work in the restaurants, no one ever treated me like I was the boss's son. I was whatever position he made me. I loved growing up and going into the restaurants with him because, A, I got to spend time with him. I got to just spend like incredible quality time with the guy that was my dad, my best friend, my mentor. B, in hindsight, I got to learn humility. I got to learn compassion. I got to develop a good work ethic all through just working different positions in a restaurant. And B, I got to fall in love with the world of hospitality. And I always say that in our restaurants, we have an opportunity and a responsibility to create these magical worlds in a world that needs more magic. Like, I was inspired to want to do that when I was 12 years old, going to work with my dad. Now, to be clear, he actually really wanted me to not go into restaurants. He wanted me to do anything but that for all the obvious reasons. But I was hooked. And when, this is part of my nature, once I make a decision that I want something, I have an inability to want something else after that. So, I mean, listen, I think it's important to me, the things that, you know, we always used to say, like, athletes go to the tapes when they've had a bad game to see what they want to make sure they don't do again. They don't often go to the tapes after they had a good game to make sure that they continue to do those things. If I look back at my childhood, just carving out time and work such that it can overlap with life so that you can actually find time with your kid when you're at work and they get to see all of you, not just the you that's left when you get home from work, I think will always be important to me. And then putting her in positions where she learns that there's virtue and nobility in serving other people. I think that's a skill that lasts a lifetime.
I love that. So last question I want to ask you, and it's regarding your father and your now new position as a father. What do you think the most important thing your father ever told you, or the lesson that you learned, but through words, that your father ever shared with you that you are the most excited about sharing with your daughter?
My goodness. My dad has so many good quotes he's giving me.
I know. And they're all my favorite. I know, obviously, the famous one is adversity is a terrible thing to waste. And we all know that one. But, like, what's the one that you're like, man, and I know you go back to that one a lot, but what besides that one that you're like, you know, I can't wait to share this ideal with my daughter because it's served me so well?
Ask yourself what right looks like and do that.
I love that.
And what that means, and he's reminded me of this as I've gone through some of the more challenging transitions in my life. He's saying, hey, like, let's say you have something tumultuous on the horizon. He has always sat down with me and said, okay, I want you to make a decision right now that at every single pass over the next year, you're going to ask yourself what right looks like and do that. Okay, your dad says that to you. It's an easy thing to be like, yeah, of course, Dad. I'm going to do that. He goes, no. Because honestly, there are going to be plenty of times when what right looks like isn't necessarily best for you financially. It's not best for you in a bunch of different ways. It's just what's right. And so his whole thing was make the decision at a certain point in life that no matter what right looks like, no matter how good it is for you and in the short term or from a financial perspective or in a bunch of other ways, that you just always do that. His whole thing has always been like, listen, you can make money again. You can grow companies again. There's virtually nothing that you can lose that you can't get back. But integrity. The moment you act in the absence of integrity, the moment you ask yourself what right looks like and you do the other thing, you can never get that back. That's a moment that if you are the person that you want to be, you're going to regret for the rest of your life. And we all have those moments. I don't know anyone that's always done the thing that's right. But if I can encourage her to, at every, you know, fork in the road, to ask that question and and encourage her to, as often as possible, do what right looks like, I'll feel like I passed on a pretty important lesson that I learned from my dad.
Well, I don't think there's a better way to end a podcast than that. Well, I have to thank you from the bottom of my heart for coming on The Main Ingredient with David Nayfeld. For me, it's just a treat to catch up with you, but I also just, I like to memorialize the words of people that I admire, because I think these will ultimately be the lessons for our industry for the future. So I appreciate you. I personally can't wait to see what the future is, not only for you as a professional, but for us as friends. And, you know, all love to you, my friend.
I'm so proud of everything you've accomplished, man. And it was really nice being on this with you.
Thank you.
The main ingredient.